Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are live. Welcome to the first NBA strategy show of the season. We're kicking it off tomorrow with actual games, but I think it's probably best that we talk a little bit about just the holistic nature of NBA in general. I am Josh Engelman. I am joined by Adam Scher, Ship My Money. We're just going to talk generic NBA DFS for the next, 45 minutes to an hour. Maybe touch on some questions for anybody that happens to be in chat. We're going to get to those at the end, unless they are super, super relevant to what we're talking about for each individual topic. But let's just start here. Adam, you excited to have the NBA back?
Yeah, really excited. It's always, by the time it comes back, I'm always very, very ready for it because you've had months and months and months of the volatility and variance of baseball, and then football gets added in. If you're me, hockey gets added in since now I'm an avid hockey DFS player. So yeah, it's always the appeal of just being like, yeah, I know what's going to happen more or less in this game is always pretty enticing. And then, you know, by the end of NBA season, I'm ready for the volatility of baseball again. But yeah, it's always really exciting when it starts.
The biggest problem with NBA by the time we get to the end of the season is that I think you actually have to work at the NBA, and that's why baseball feels so good. It's like, okay, we just paste these lineups in and we can move ahead. But with the NBA, I mean, there's no... You got to be active. It helps to have an Awesomeo subscription and get out in front of everything with projections and minutes and boom bust tools and ownership and all that stuff. That's going to thin it out for the large majority of people. For you and I, it's a lot of work. NBA is a lot of work on the back end.
Yeah, I was actually kind of thinking about that the other day because you get used to, like you were saying, baseball. It's kind of just like, okay, well, I have nothing to do during the day. I do my show in the morning and then I come back and do my one at night, plug in some lineups. But yeah, for NBA, it's like, oh man, I'm going to, wake up and just get to work. And it does feel more like a job, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, it's the best job you can have for all intents and purposes. It is our literal job, but if I got to wake up in the morning and the worst part about my job is that I have to do research about the NBA and then talk about it, I'm not in any position to complain about anything ever.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right. So we've got a couple of different topics that we're going to touch on over the next hour-ish. We want to talk cash games. We want to talk GPPs. We want to talk late swap. We want to talk short slates. And then we're going to touch a little bit on showdown slash single game type stuff. Before we do any of that right now, please hit that like button. Subscribe to this channel. There is going to be constant NBA content coming out on this channel, and you don't want to miss it. Contenders videos, strategy show, The Process, which is kicking off tomorrow at 6:30 a.m. Eastern time. Make sure you're here for it. The Deeper Dive, Live Before Lock. I'm probably missing more video content. We certainly have a ton of written content and tools on the website. You don't want to miss any of it, so make sure that you're subscribing to this channel. Adam, I think the easiest place for us to start it off is talking about cash games. And this is one of the few places where we can sort of talk about locks, because they don't, generally speaking, exist in GPPs. And nothing is ever a lock in DFS, but cash games get closer to it. When we're talking about the best plays on the slate, this is where we're going to get people into lineups. The highest owned players on an individual slate likely to be heavily, heavily owned in cash games. So if you're thinking about cash, do you have like a general definition for it or a general thought process when you just think cash games?
I mean, it's kind of just, you know, to play the best plays, as you know, obvious as that sounds, but you're really the way that kind of helps me think about it. When, you know, if I'm trying to like decide between a couple of plays or a couple of lineups, is you're really just trying to play like the best median lineups. You know, you're just trying to like win 51% of the time, basically. So it's more straightforward than tournaments, as far as, you know, you're not really concerned about what your opponents are doing, as far as, you know, ownership goes. But yeah, you're just kind of, you're trying to play the players that give you the best chance of just consistently having a good lineup, is, I guess, the way I think about it.
So I know for you and I, and for a decent chunk of people, we're going to have a different starting method. If you are using an optimizer, if you have access to one, if you're using Fantasy Cruncher, which I am, which Adam is, which is available for you on our website, you're going to start a little bit differently, I think. You and I are probably in the same boat here, but I want to make sure that we are on the same page. If we're talking about a cash lineup, the first thing that we're probably doing is running a totally unencumbered crunch in Fantasy Cruncher. Full exposure, no randomness, no additional uniques, no rules, no anything like that. We just want to know what's your most optimal lineup based on our projections, or maybe so. What's your most like 10 optimal lineups, 15 optimal lineups, a decent chunk. But what we're really doing is not touching any settings.
Yeah, exactly. Like the first thing I want to do is just see where my absolute top projected lineups are, because from there I can, you know, make decisions, you know, how many points, basically I want to know how many points am I giving up for every decision I make off of the top projected lineup that I can build, because that's going to be important when it comes down to, you know, trying to decide between individual players, whether it's, you know, you think one player's minutes are more consistent, even but his median projection is a little bit lower, or if it's a situation where it's like, well, do I want two centers from the same team? You really want to know how much you're giving up in terms of projection for any decision you make. So yeah, the first thing I want to know is just, if I don't set any rules, you know, I let two centers be in the same lineup, I don't have any sort of randomness or anything like that, I just want to know what's the top raw projected lineup I can make, and then go from there.
If you have no access to an optimizer, if you're not willing to pay for it, yeah, you're not trying to use any of the free options that exist, if you're just not an optimizer person, but you still want to try to play cash games, what's sort of the first step you would try to go through in order to put that lineup together? Are you going directly to our projections table, sort of sorting by value and start piecing people in there? Because ultimately, we're just trying to recreate what the optimizer does quickly.
Yeah, I mean, for NBA cash, honestly, if you're going to hand build, I would just say don't, you know, play tournaments. But if you are going to try and hand build for cash, it's like you said, you're just going to try and recreate what the optimizer is doing. So you're going to want to basically know who the top raw projected scorers are, and you're going to want to know who the top value pieces are. I think in general, hand building, I've always, and I haven't done it in years, but when I started out, I did it. And I always preferred like the bottom up approach, I guess, is what people refer to, where I kind of just put in like the cheapest options at every position that I could stomach. And then you see how much money you have left and you see where the best upgrades are. And that's where, you know, the raw point totals will come in. So that was my approach for hand building. That's how I would do it here. But again, you know, if, especially in NBA cash, because it's really difficult, I would just highly recommend using an optimizer to make sure that you're not making unnecessary mistakes.
Now, if you're using, this could help you out quite a bit if you're not using the optimizer, you can use our lineup builder. This is at osimo.com. It comes with your subscription. You can click and add everybody individually into each lineup. You will also get a score for projection and a score for how contrarian your lineup is. If you're building a cash lineup in our lineup builder, FanDuel, DraftKings, any sport, any setup, anything at all, this holds true not just for basketball, but for everything from a cash perspective. You are looking for your projection or your fantasy point score to be greater than 90%. You want this to be as close to your optimal as possible. You also want the contrarian number to be less than 10% or likely less than 10%. That one can have at least a little bit of wiggle room, just sort of depending on what the slate is looking like. But more often than not, you want highly projected and probably very highly owned as well. So let's talk about those ownership factors. How much does ownership play a role in the decisions you're making for a cash game?
I'll use it as a tiebreaker. It's not something that I'm looking at from the very beginning. I'm not building my lineups based on ownership. I'm trying to get, you know, the best lineups I can, regardless of ownership, because in theory, if there's a player that I think is, you know, that I'm confident is one of the best plays on the slate and he was 1% owned, I would absolutely love to play him in cash, because then I'm most likely going to just, you know, clean up. But where it does matter for me is especially if I'm playing 50-50s, double ups, formats where there's no extra reward for coming in, you know, first place as opposed to 50th percent or 51st percentile. There it's, you know, if I have two lineups that project the same, give or take, and I don't feel strongly one way or the other in terms of floor, you know, like I think that the minutes for everyone in both lineups are consistent, then the ownership matters, because there's no real reason for me to put myself in a position where I'm playing a 3% owned guy instead of a you know, 45% owned guy, because there's no extra reward if the 3% owned guy beats the 45% owned guy, but there is more risk, because if the 45% owned guy wins what I think is a coin flip, I'm putting myself in a really, really difficult situation to overcome. So especially in 50-50 and double up formats, I'll use it as a tiebreaker.
The next bullet point I have in my list of things to ask you are, what are the differences between head-to-heads and 50-50s and double ups? So you led yourself right into it. It's perfect. 50-50s
and double ups. I looked at the run sheet. It's funny how that works.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, look at that. Turning over a new leaf for this new NBA season. It's fantastic. But yeah, that is where we are going right now. It is going to be slightly different for head-to-heads than 50-50s and double-ups, because there is upside available for you in head-to-heads. More often than not, you're probably going to lean on the side of ownership. If you're getting a one percenter in a cash game, there's a decent chance you have that person projected, I don't want to say incorrectly, but like, there's a reason it's happening. And if there's a comparably owned 20%er guy with 0.1 less in the projection, it kind of makes your decision for you. And that's why in that first step, you're probably running more than just one lineup as the crunch. You're getting 15 to 20. Because if you have a lineup projected for, say, 300 fantasy points, and the second one is projected for 299.9, those are the same lineups for all intents and purposes. You do want to see what the constitution of that lineup really is anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Do we have anything else that you think we should be touching on from a cash game perspective?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I guess just to take from a more macro perspective for a second, as far as the 50-50s and double ups go, versus, you know, head to heads, you know, you're likely in 50-50s and double ups to either you know, more or less double your money or get a 0% return. 50-50s, you're going to get, you know, a more true return based on the percentile of your lineup. If you're playing, you know, a wide range of head-to-head opponents and you make a 25th percentile lineup, you're getting $0 back in 50-50s, but you're getting 25% back in head-to-heads. So it is, I think, a little bit safer way to, you know, grow your bankroll if you're someone that has, you know, a limited bankroll, you're starting out. But, you know, typically you're going to want to just mix in both versions of games. But that is always something that I think is worth mentioning.
Also, from a contest selection perspective, at least for 50-50s and double ups, I would lean towards the largest field single entry type stuff that you can get into first. Anytime that you can minimize the amount of the player pool that gets to overtake it with a large percentage of lineups, you want to do that. So if you can get into, like, just say a 2,000 person double up that's single entry, that's a really nice contest to be able to get into. If that's a 2,000 person double up, but you're allowed to 150 max it as well, the sharps can concentrate significantly more. You want as many people as possible in there with not a lot of bullets.
Yeah, and FanDuel in particular is really good for this. They always have single entry 100 person 50-50s at... Yeah. I think like every price point up to $25. So that is one thing, and they fill. So that is one thing that's really, really good about FanDuel that, you know, you can utilize.
All right. We've got cash games out of the way now. Time to transition to the thing that I think most people are interested in. And that would be just general GPP discussion. And this has changed so much in the industry over the past couple of years. Like a good cash play, all of the good cash plays are, in theory, good GPP plays, depending on what their ownership is. That's where the distinctions lie. If someone is a great value, that's probably still a good GPP play. But if they're 90% owned and they should be 20% owned, that's where the differences change. So just in a general sense, what is your approach for GPPs in comparison to a cash game?
So I think that's a really good point because you hear it a lot, you know, oh, I don't think this guy's a good GPP play, but he's good in cash, or, you know, even vice versa. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. For one, if somebody's a bad GPP play, they're not a good cash play. Like that's pretty impossible.
Yep.
But it's still, it's more complicated than just looking and saying, oh, I don't want to play any popular players, especially in NBA, because one thing that, you know, NBA is very different than most other sports. When you like what you would consider a highly owned player, because it all comes back to how projectable NBA is. You know, when you're talking about a sport like baseball or football and you get a hitter or, you know, a wide receiver at 30% in tournaments, you can normally just say, man, that's really, really popular. I'll go somewhere else. 30% in NBA is not that popular typically because it's just easier to project what they're going to do. So players that you would be playing in cash games are always going to be players that, to at least to a certain point, are going to be good GPP plays, have a spot in lineups because they're just the best plays on the slate. And there's not a, you're not going to be wrong on them all that often.
And you and I have been talking about it a lot on either just NFL prep shows or even in the NBA over the past year. Let's just say that we have this guy that is projecting as, you know, the very clear-cut best cash option. And you'll immediately get people saying, this guy, you should be playing this guy in tournaments. He's a fade. It's what the biggest piece of all of this information is going to be, what contest are you actually entering with that guy? And what does the rest of your lineup look like? There is no downside at all to be playing the best plays on the slate so long as you're accounting for it in the rest of your lineup construction, whether that's in the other eight spots on FanDuel or the other seven on DraftKings. There is no hard... It had been a thought process in the past for DFS contests. This is not the case any longer. You can make rosters with even like the three most popular plays on a given slate. So long as you know what you're doing in the rest of your lineup and you're making sure you're comparing your ownership or your projected ownership to your expected chances of success. So I guess the biggest takeaway that I want for GPPs is don't immediately think that you have to fade chalk because it's chalk. That's just not the case any longer. You just have to be smarter about your roster construction.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's one thing that it's a big change between what DFS used to be back, you know, when I started in like 2015, 2016. There was a lot there weren't really good public projections out there. There was a lot less, there were a lot less tools that you could use to build good lineups. So back then it was typically, you would kind of get groupthink on specific players and they weren't necessarily that good play, that good of plays. Now with all the information that's out there, all the really good public projections, typically the players that are going to be really popular are the best plays on the slate. And so it's not as easy. Like you're just putting yourself in a hole if your thought process is don't play popular players, because there's such a correlation these days between the popular players also being the best plays. So what it comes down to, and you hit on it, it's really two things for me. One, within my lineup, what the other pieces of my lineup are going to determine if I'm willing to play, you know, how many popular players I'm willing to play. If I have a lineup that has a couple of guys that are projected to be 1 or 2% owned, I don't care all that much about the rest of my lineup because I already have my stand on, you know, if the 2% owned guys do well, in theory, I want the best plays around them because those are the guys that the 2% owned guys are vaulting me up the leaderboard. I don't want to have to, you know, get lucky on like three other players too. But also it's chances of success versus ownership. Ownership by itself is close to meaningless. It tells you, you know, it can tell you how likely you are to be duplicated, but just talking about a player's ownership without considering their chances of success, it doesn't make any sense. If you have, you know, you see it in NBA a lot, you have a $3,000 point guard sliding in and expected to play 35 minutes. He, let's say, has a 90% chance, just throwing a number out there, of being the best, you know, $3,000 play. If he's 75% owned, that's a really high number. It's not as high as it should be, and you should be playing him a lot. Vice versa, you know, if you have, you see this at center a lot because it's, you know, a more limited position. If you have a center that is a really good play and he's getting 25% ownership, that could be too high because there's so many other good centers. You know, maybe he only has an 18% chance of success. So the raw ownership number isn't really that useful when you're evaluating players that are good tournament plays, for lack of a better word. It's a two-part thing, you know, the other component being how likely are they to succeed versus the alternatives,
which you just detailed perfectly as my what I was going to talk about for good chalk and bad chalk. That is sort of individually dependent, but it doesn't, if someone is bad chalk, that doesn't mean they end up in 0% of your lineups either. It's just dependent on what's in the rest of that lineup. Good chalk is going to be a guy that's 60% owned that we have in our optimal percentages on our boom bust tool that should be in 80% of lineups. Then you should still be over the field, or can still be over the field if you would like. So the good chalk, bad chalk mentality is also just not a thing that people should be talking about the same way that we did, say, I don't know, when this channel probably started. Very different thought process altogether now.
Yeah, and one other thing that you kind of mentioned there, but I think it gets talked about too much, and I think part of the reason is that it's kind of like an easy crutch when you're doing shows, and it kind of gets translated into, you know, other people talking about it that way too. The, you know, looking at a player and saying, oh, I want to be over the field or I want to be under the field, I don't think is the best approach. It's kind of a simplistic way of saying it, but looking at individual players and trying to decide if you want more or less than the field, I think is going to be a more difficult way to build good tournament lineups than having a more like macro lineup building process and just building lineups that meet criteria, you know, whether it's your lineup as a whole is projected to be under-owned or, you know, you don't have that's the way I prefer to do it. I know some people do it, you know, it doesn't have more than X percent ownership, but building lineups and then from there, seeing how it shakes out, you know, seeing what players you end up being over or under the field on, I think is just the better way of doing it than going in and saying, oh, I don't like this player being 30% owned. You're just going to put yourself in a position where a lot of times you kind of don't realize that the player is more necessary or less necessary than you think. And you kind of just like force yourself into building lineups that aren't as good as they could be.
You mentioned the total ownership and people building towards the cutoff. And I understand where that thought process is coming from. Don't think that you need to do that and set some number in stone. That number is going to be different on every single slate you play based on whatever the ownership is for individual players. It's going to be different on a 3-game slate than it is for an 8-game slate because the grand total is just going to be lower. So you're either going to need to recalculate that for yourself every day and, you know, run a crunch of 1,000 lineups and figure out what that threshold is going to be, or you just need to be prepared to do something differently, because you cannot, you, that is not a one size fits all number that you should be using across multiple slates or contests or anything like that. It's too tough. You've got to change it for too many different factors.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's, everything's relative to each other in terms of lineups. And so, yeah, you don't want to go in saying, oh, I'm never going to play a lineup that exceeds, you know, 165% ownership sum or something. Yeah. Like, you know, you can kind of use it as a general rule. Again, I think there's better ways to do it, but you can use it as a general rule just to make sure that you're not, when you run Fantasy Cruncher, you're not just getting lineups that are just jamming all of the chalk together, and then, you know, other lineups that are all 1% owned plays. Like, you can use it as a proxy, but you definitely don't want to be too strict with it. And you really want to keep in mind that that ultimately the ownership of your lineups, all that really matters is, you know, how it compares to the other lineups that you could play.
How do you use the size of a contest and the payout structure of a contest to determine the construction of your lineups?
I mean, in general, the larger the field, the more top heavy it is, the more willing you should be to take risks. The one sort of caveat to that is those are also typically the tournaments with the weakest fields, because like you were saying, in cash games, the larger the tournament gets, the lower percentage of the field good players makes up. So that is one thing that I don't go too crazy in terms of adjusting. Like if I'm playing a $100, you know, 1,000-person tournament, and then I'm playing a $20, 15,000-person tournament, I actually don't go too crazy, you know, as far as trying to like be more contrarian in the 15,000 person tournament, because the field's weaker. So the ownership is just not going to be as high on the guys that I want to play. Whereas in that $100, 1,000 person one, the field isn't as big, but it's a lot higher percentage of good players. So the ownership is going to be higher on the guys that I want to play. So I still, you know, want contrarian lineups in there too. So, you know, you can, the bigger the tournament gets, you know, the more, I think you can make a case for taking more flyers on low probability guys, but in general, I think it kind of balances out because of the weaker field.
What is your opinion? And this is a question we get a lot. What is your opinion on stacking in the NBA?
I typically don't worry about it, especially on full size slates. I think it becomes more relevant on smaller slates, but I don't worry about it too much. There is positive correlation in getting players from the same game, just because, you know, the same reason there is in other sports. If a game has a 215 point total, projections are going to be based on that, and they're going to assume that the game scores 215 points. If for one reason or another that game scores 230 points, you know, the one team's playing faster than anticipated, or the refs have, you know, a strict whistle and guys are getting to the line constantly, it's going to benefit everyone in that game. And also, if it goes to overtime, it's going to benefit, you know, the starters at least. So I think that there is a benefit, but also it's not as important to me, because one of the reasons that stacking makes so much sense in sports like baseball and football, everyone talks about the correlation, but really, if you go back and look at the best possible lineup in those sports that you could make on any given slate, it's typically not a stack. Yeah. It's that it's so difficult to project those sports. You're going to have more success by correlating your lineups and basically saying, you know, I'm not going to be very good at projecting what happens in this game. So I just want it to be, you know, if the Red Sox do well, I just want all their hitters together. That's going to make it a little bit easier to be right. Whereas in basketball, it's a lot easier to project individually how guys are going to do. So the sacrifice, the opportunity cost of correlating.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Is a bit higher than in the sports that have more variance. So there is still positive correlation to be had in NBA. It just plays a much smaller role than in other sports, I think.
Any other major tenets for GPPs that you want to make sure that you touch on?
As far as the stacking goes too, I guess one thing that I do sort of like doing is I think instead of like forcing game stacks, you can, in Fantasy Cruncher, you can bump players. And so, you know, doing something like, you know, if Chris Paul is in this lineup, let's say, you know, Chris Paul is playing against the Lakers. If Chris Paul is in this lineup, bump LeBron's projection by 10%, something like that, like taking the star from both teams and making it so that, you know, maybe you get them in the same lineup together, I think is one way where you can increase the correlation, the positive correlation of your lineup, but you're also not, you know, taking up five roster spots to do it.
The next thing that we need to talk about, and this is generally going to be coming from a GPP stance, but it's certainly available in cash. I know it helped you out in NFL cash earlier this season, and that would be late swap. Let's start here. Before we look at Fantasy Cruncher, why would you late swap?
To increase your chances of getting some sort of return. Like if you're, so in cash, if your early players do well, you're not going to late swap off of what you think is, you know, the best players coming up. But where you would want to do it in cash is, you know, if you, let's say you're playing in a 50-50 and you have a 35% owned guy who gets in foul trouble and, you know, ends up scoring like 12 fantasy points. If he's not, you know, 80% owned or something like that, he's actually going to matter in that contest. There's a good chance that you're kind of going to be blocked on those best plays if you leave them in your lineup. And so it's going to make it so you're just not going to get into the top 50% of that field. So switching to lower owned players that project similarly, but not quite as good to what you originally had, it's just going to make it so that you get more money back in the long run. Head to heads, I think, is kind of the easiest way, the best example, easiest way to think about it. If I'm playing you head to head and I know that based on, you're most likely, you know, that based on the salary you have left and the positions you have left, we have the same two players in the 10-30 game, and you're beating me by 5 points at the end of, you know, the early games, it's impossible for me to win unless I switch. And so you're just going to obviously make more money over the long run by taking a slightly suboptimal two players and playing them instead. And, you know, knowing that they're going to beat those better projected players a relatively high percentage of the time.
Now, if you're using Fantasy Cruncher, this is not something that you need to worry about. But if you are building by hand, the key piece for you here, if you're trying to prepare for late swaps, is having guys that play the latest. And this is, I guess, only relevant for DraftKings, since there isn't flex in general positions. You want the guys playing the latest in the guard spot, the forward spot, and the utility spot of an NBA lineup, because you want to have the easiest time to swap these guys out as we move on later. Lock in the individual positions first, lock in the easy to swap positions later. Fantasy Cruncher will automatically do this for you and put people where they belong. But if you're building by hand, try not to put people that play at 10 o'clock in point guard through center, unless you don't have a choice, unless they're the only option for that spot.
Yeah. And on a side note, when you're looking at head to heads, when you see an opponent that did that, you know, that has like a 7 o'clock player in the utility spot, that's typically someone that you're going to want to play more just because they, like, if they're messing up that sort of decision, they're probably messing up a lot of other ones. So definitely something to pay attention to just to increase your flexibility.
Yep. Write that person's name down for sure. If you could subscribe to people on FanDuel or DraftKings, that would be what you would want to do. But instead, just subscribe to this channel right now. That was a good transition. I'm pretty happy about it. All right. So how to late swap? Let's talk about it here. And I can give a mild example. We're going to pop this up on the screen. Let's see. I think I just clicked this button. Look at that. All right. So we've got Fantasy Cruncher open on the screen right now. This is my FC for FanDuel. It's pretty simple. All you have to do is basically worry about two things. And Late Swaptimizer will help you out by removing these games. You could also manually remove the games that have already started by just coming over to the game filter. You can click the at symbol. That would take, like, let's say we were trying to late swap for Golden State and the Lakers. You can click this at symbol that will take Brooklyn and Milwaukee out of it. Or when you run the Late Swaptimizer, it will prompt you. You will go to whichever site you're playing on. If this is DraftKings or FanDuel, you need to download your contest CSV. These things update as, I minimized it and made it go away. These things update as the slate changes. So you constantly need to be re-downloading these things as you go along. But you'll go to DraftKings, you'll go to FanDuel, you will download your contest CSV. You will click on the late swaptimizer button and either select that CSV or drop it into this box. When you do, you will get a pop-up of all of your lineups, at which point, what I like to do personally, and I don't know if yours is a little bit different, I immediately like to filter down to guys that I know aren't in. So say that someone got, all right, say it's Golden State and the Lakers tomorrow, and we get word that, I don't know, Otto Porter is scratched. I will immediately go to just my Otto Porter lineups by filtering down and then recrunch everything that I have for Otto Porter just to make sure that I don't have him any longer. From there, you can go into a deeper recrunch of everything for all 150 if you would like. But the first thing that I'm trying to do is make sure that I don't have any holes in my lineups. Are you worrying about that first step, or are you handling it all in one step?
No, I do it also because one reason is that if you have settings, like if you have rules that don't that can't be applied to your late swaps, you'll still get Otto Porter in lineups. So I do that too, just so I can quickly say, like, okay, you know, is anything breaking here? You know, am I still, when I recrunch and take Otto Porter out, am I still getting a bunch of lineups down at the bottom with like that caution symbol telling me that Otto Porter is still in? And if so, why is that? Like, what rule do I need to change? It's just easier for me to figure that out when I'm looking specifically at those lineups.
Now, we can go into way more details on late swap. This is just going to be a very quick high level run. When you are done your late swaps, all you have to do is click the export button on Fantasy Cruncher. It'll be at the bottom of the screen. It won't be just like this, but you'll export your lineups, you'll save it, and you'll upload them right back again to FanDuel or DraftKings. It's a really simple process, but it is also a process that is tough to fully learn out of the gate. A lot of people are going to run into issues if you still have exposure caps set. Randomness could play a role into it. If you have rules or salary constraints, all of those things are going to make your late swapping experience different. You need to be aware of what you have in there. My recommendation, probably, at least to practice, is to clear everything out that you have, recrunch, and figure out what individual settings do when you're trying to late swap, because it's a different mechanism than it is when you're building naturally, because every one of your lineups is just slightly different at that point. Do you have any like best practices for late swapping that you would want to add?
Well, I agree with you. It's one of those things where I think, you know, it kind of sucks, but the most effective way is to just do it. And like you said, kind of start from scratch, see what different things do, how it affects your lineups. Because just like when we talk about building lineups at the, you know, before the slate, ultimately you're just trying to get Fantasy Cruncher to build lineups that you would build just, you know, yeah, more efficiently. So it's kind of the same thing with late swapping. Like for me, I like setting it so that my late swaps still are under-owned. You know, like I'll put in the actual ownership of players that I know at that point. And, you know, so that my lineups still, you know, are properly leveraged, for lack of a better way of saying it. But, you know, again, that's something that it goes along with my initial process too. And everyone has different ways that they build their lineup. So the big thing is just being familiar with it, understanding what, you know, if I change this setting, what is going to happen to the lineups that I build now? And that's something that really you just get from experience.
I don't think I have anything else on late swaps. It's just something that you want to pay close attention to. And you sort of just alluded to this, but remember, Fantasy Cruncher doesn't know anything about the sports. It's only trying to maximize fantasy points based on the constraints that you have given it. It doesn't know the names of players. It's not trying to do anything. It's not giving you anything other than the most correct answer for that particular stance. So if you're not getting something that you think you want to get, it's either not correct or you need to learn how to manipulate it yourself. It's only going to do it. It's like yelling at a calculator for giving you the answer. That's all that this is. Okay, so we talked cash games, we talked GPPs, we talked late swap. I do want to touch on short slates. So that's pretty important on a day like today because we're kicking it off with two games tomorrow. You mentioned this when we were talking about GPPs and stacking before, but obviously you're doing more game stacking on a short slate. Is it intentional or is it just by default?
It's intentional because it goes back to what I was saying, why I think that, you know, getting positive correlation into your lineups in NBA is obviously good, but the opportunity cost is higher than it is in other sports because of how projectable NBA is. On a two-game slate, the opportunity cost is going to be lower just because there's less players to choose from. So, you know, as opposed on a two-game slate, you know, let's say I decide to force in five guys from, you know, game one, it's not that those roster spots just aren't costing me as much as if it means I'm foregoing, you know, guys from eight different games. There's a really good chance that there's several players there that I'm just not getting to as much from those eight games because I'm forcing in a stack of this one game. When you're just talking about two games, it's a lot less likely that there's some player you're missing out on that's going to have a massive game. And you're also putting yourself in a position where, you know, whichever game ends up being the highest scoring out of the two, there's a good chance that the winning lineups are just going to have a lot of players from that game. So I'm just a lot more willing to, you know, sacrifice roster spots in the sake of correlation when I have less competition for those roster spots.
This is another thing that we didn't really touch on for the GPP section, but I wanted to at least hit on it here, and it'll allow us to work our way backwards. On a short slate, I am significantly more likely to be playing someone's direct backup.
Yep.
On a large slate, it's basically like a chance where I would never be doing that, so long as they are largely direct. And salary plays a huge role here. For the longest time, it was like Jokic and Plumlee was the easiest example for this. Jokic was going to play 34 minutes. Plumlee was going to play the other 14, maybe like 2 minutes alongside. You know, you rarely wanted Jokic and Plumlee at the same time because if Jokic, like for them to get there, they're competing with each other. On a short slate, I think it's different because you can just sort of corner every single minute that is played at a particular position and you don't have enough options otherwise to try to do it. So I think you and I do the same thing for NBA slates. We're rarely getting direct backups in the same lineup in a large field, but we are more willing to do it on a short slate.
Yeah, and it just comes back to the opportunity cost of positions again. You know, outside of, you know, sometimes there'll be like that rare case where a starting center is out and you have like 2-3K centers, you know, and you can play them together because they're each going to play 24 minutes or whatever. But outside of cases like that, like using the Jokic and Plumlee example, on a full slate, I'm just never playing them together because if I'm playing Plumlee, I really want the game where Jokic gets in foul trouble and Plumlee plays an extra 6 minutes. And if that happens, clearly I don't want Jokic in that lineup. But if there's, you know, 10 games on the slate, the opportunity cost is much higher. It's very unlikely that if Jokic gets in foul trouble, he still ends up being one of the best plays. On a two-game slate, Jokic can miss, you know, if you're projecting him for 34 minutes and he only plays 26 minutes because he's in foul trouble, Plumlee can have a big game because he gets those extra minutes, and Jokic can still be one of the top scorers because there's only two games worth of players to choose from. So the opportunity cost just really decreases. And then also it becomes a situation where in tournaments, obviously when you have less players to choose from, when there's only two games, everyone's ownership goes up. It becomes more difficult to build lineups that aren't going to be duplicated and that are still, you know, reasonable lineups. So that is one way where, yeah, you're taking, it's not preferable to have Jokic and Plumlee together, but a lot of people are still going to be setting rules not to do that. And since there's still a path to, you know, Plumlee getting extra minutes and Jokic being one of the top raw scorers, the fact that a lot of people are just not going to allow that lineup to be built is beneficial to you as well. So it really just comes back to, you know, opportunity cost of each roster spot is much lower on a two-game slate than on a 10-game slate.
Something that I want to top off on for the short slate section and what we're talking about here is that just because something is negatively correlated doesn't mean that you should never do it. And this is something that I touched on a lot on the process show last year. But when you're trying to make an optimal on this short slate, whatever your optimizer is or Fantasy Cruncher or even just the optimal lineup in general, it doesn't know that guys are each other's direct backups. It's just maximizing two separate numbers for that particular constraint. So there's nothing to ever stop those guys from being in a lineup together. That's why salary is so important in DFS, because if two guys are underpriced by $1,000 each, you're more likely to be able to get to them both in the same lineup, because in the grand scheme of things, there's nothing stopping those numbers from being in the same lineup together. As the field gets bigger, you need more than just your success to work. You also need to hope that other people then fail. On the short slate, it's different.
Yeah, and also that goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning with cash lineups and starting out without any rules. You know, if somehow on a 10-game slate, my top lineup has Jokic and Plumlee together, and that's projected like 5 points higher than my top lineup. If I say don't play Plumlee and Jokic together, then it's probably telling me I should go ahead and play them together. But on a 10 game slate, that's like never going to happen. Whereas on a 2 game slate, it very easily could.
All right, let's close this entire video out now talking a little bit about showdown / single entry, depending on which site you're playing on. And the biggest piece here comes down to the differences in scoring systems. On DraftKings with the captain, not only do you get a 1.5x bonus on scoring, you also are multiplying the salary by 1.5x as well. So it scales upward. FanDuel is different. FanDuel's got, what, MVP star and pro plus two flex spots. The salary is not changing in these instances. And that really changes the dynamic of the game, because on FanDuel, you pretty much need to align the highest scorers in that game in order. On DraftKings, it's different, because you can make up for lack of scoring in one spot by having more high-end talent across the rest of your utility. So how do you generally think about the differences between DraftKings and FanDuel with regards to single game contests?
I just think, I mean, for one, the DraftKings format is much better as a player, because you can, you always want, especially like if you're talking about tournaments, you always want there to be a risk reward dynamic, where if you're playing a quote unquote worst player at captain, there's a reward, you know, because he's lower owned. But the price changing makes it so like you get, not only do you get the lower ownership, but you get a reward where you can get better utility players. On FanDuel, you're basically just saying, okay, I need, I don't even know who's on the Lakers outside of Russ and LeBron and Davis anymore, but you know, I need their fourth scorer to outscore LeBron. Like, that's not happening. So it kind of becomes useless. Whereas on DraftKings, you're saving a bunch of money, and so it's going to let you get, let's say, LeBron plus Davis. Whereas if you play LeBron at captain, you can't get Davis. So I think just the format is much better. And the reasoning is that, you know, you just can be more creative. You can, you get more choices that can reasonably succeed.
Are you setting groups? And this is going to be more of an optimizer setting, but are you likely to set groups for showdowns, or are you sort of just letting the chips fall as they may?
Pretty much letting the chips fall where they may. The one thing that, or really the group that I would use the most, is there's a lot of times there's going to be a situation where, you know, who's the eighth guy in the rotation, or who's the ninth guy in the rotation? Like, maybe it's Solomon Hill, maybe it's Brandon Goodwin, we don't know. But they are both really cheap and they're both really low owned. I don't want to really guess and say, oh, you know, I even though I have no idea, I'm going to just play Solomon Hill and not play Brandon Goodwin. But I also obviously don't want them in the same lineup, since I think one of them is going to play and one of them isn't. So, you know, using something like that, where you don't really know what the rotation is going to be, but you do know the group of guys that's going to take those minutes in some way, that's a group that I set. But like, I'm not going to be too concerned about, you know, the Jokic versus Plumlee situation, since it's only one game.
Is there anything else that we should be touching on from a showdown perspective? I don't think that there's anything else that's super unique that changes the way that we talked about cash games or GPPs or slates prior.
Right. It's obviously it's different, because, you know, the format is different and all of that, but the concepts are the same. You're going to approach cash the same way that, you know, similar process that you would for a full slate. You're going to approach tournaments the same way, or similar, you know, a similar way. You're going to still be trying to build lineups that are projected well while being, you know, under owned. So it's, you know, the numbers change, the settings change, but the process, the general way of thinking about it, it's going to be the same.
I don't have anything else for anything that I had originally prepared for us to talk about here. I do see a question in chat that I'd like to touch on. Said Josh, it's from Brian, said, Josh or Adam, as it pertains to money left on the table, can you talk about that? Like golf, we're able to leave a few hundred or a thousand. What about NBA? I'll give it to you right now. I know that we're going to have the same answer.
Yeah, I mean, typically you're not going to want to. Like, there's always exceptions, especially in like April when you just get teams resting everybody. But it's riskier to do in NBA than in any other sport. And like, even in other sports, you don't really want to do it all that much, because typically pricing is pretty efficient. But there's just so much volatility in football and in baseball and in golf. You know, you're going to have plenty of games where like the third wide receiver beats the number one wide receiver and he's $6,000 less expensive, but scores, you know, actually more fantasy points. You're not barring, you know, injury, you're not going to have games where the fifth start, the fifth highest usage guy on the Lakers scores more fantasy points than LeBron. He might end up being a better point per dollar play, but he's not scoring more actual fantasy points. And so just because of how projectable NBA is and the fact that it's not event-based, you're going to be putting yourself in a hole typically if you're just running lineups that have like, you know, 48 that leave like $1,500 on the table.
Yeah. If you're leaving that after late swaps, very different story as the slate's playing on. But generally speaking, pre-lock, I don't have a number because that's not something I'm going to pay attention to. I just know that given the amount of, like, Wednesday slate, for example, 11-game slate, I just know that I'm not going to be generating a ton of lineups that are leaving a lot of salary on the table. It's just not necessary because there are too many choices to generate lineups that use it all, and they're still really good lineups. There's too many different options. So from a basketball perspective, I'm rarely paying attention to it because most of my lineups, I would guess, are probably like $500 or less.
Yeah, exactly. It's, and like you were saying, it's not something I really need to pay attention to because like I can turn randomness and Fantasy Cruncher up as much as I want. Yeah. And it's still going to give me lineups that are pretty close to the max just because there's so many different players you can use that, you know, it's not something I really need to pay attention to.
One other question from Steven Leibowitz, and I think that this one is pretty important now. Josh, I know you play FanDuel a lot. Is the MPE changing much for you in the lineup building aside from making it easier? So, this is a very interesting thing for everybody. FanDuel now has MPE, multi-position eligibility. So prior to this, it was 2 point guards, 2 shooting guards, 2 small forwards, 2 power forwards, 1 center, and those player pools were locked. There would be days where there were 2 pay-up options and a bunch of garbage small forward. Now it's a little bit different. Most people have 2 different positions that you can go to. A couple individual guys have just 1, which is hilarious. Like Bruce Brown has 1 position on FanDuel for tomorrow, which is ludicrous. Of all the guys on the Nets to have 1 position, it's the guy that plays like all 5 of them. Neither here nor there. For me personally, I wanted it. I didn't want MPE to come into play. I just really liked I've been playing FanDuel basically the exact same way, save for the year that they dropped the lowest score for a while. I'm just used to it. I know it in my head. This is going to raise the scoring just by default, which doesn't mean anything to me. I'm just aware of it. But ultimately, it's good for me. I would rather have the MPE than not have it because I think that I am less likely to make mistakes than the average player. Do you have any cares for MPE?
You and I talked about this on a show before, and we kind of disagreed. So, like, I'm with you as far as I think MPE benefits max entry players because it's going to give you a situation where essentially what ends up happening is you're just easily able to get exposure to pretty much all the players that you want because there's so many different ways to make it happen. Whereas without MPE, you know, you run in this situation like at point guard where it's like, all right, I really like Chris Paul. I really like Westbrook. I really like Damian Lillard. Can only play 2 of them. Now, you know, those guys might not be the best example because I don't know that any of them are getting shooting guard eligibility. But the point being, you know, it's going to make it easier to just get all of the guys that you want. The reason I kind of still prefer there not being MPE is I think that the math is a lot cleaner as far as determining the chances of success for each player and then figuring out if they're over-owned or under-owned. I think that the field makes more mistakes that I can capitalize on without MPE than with it, just because, again, when you have MPE, it just makes it really easy to play the guys that you want to play. And so whereas without MPE, you can get a situation where, let's say Damian Lillard is really popular and you play, Steph Curry, who for some reason isn't popular for this example. If Steph Curry goes off and beats Damian Lillard by 10 points, you've put yourself in a really, really good position. With MPE, you probably just need both guys. Or, you know, I guess, let's say Lillard and Westbrook are popular and Curry beats both of them at low ownership. Without MPE, you are... That right there is like vaulting you ahead of a lot of lineups. With MPE, the winning lineups are probably just going to have all 3 guys. And so I think it's a little bit more difficult to capitalize on people's mistakes.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything you're saying there. I think that the edge might be a little bit bigger on the stuff that I think is relevant, but I agree with what you're saying here. Another big piece for it now that does make late swapping easier for 150 maxers and people that are used to it in comparison to casuals, you're just going to be able to generate different lineups. Or people aren't doing it and you're getting that double benefit of people had never really had to worry about it before, and now I'm able to put a small forward where the power forward was. So I think there's going to be some wiggle room at the beginning where it's definitely a benefit to the people that are used to it. As it goes on, that will change.
So not only do I think it's a benefit for like 150 maxers, also it's just another reason that you should be using optimizers, because it's even easier to just make unnecessary mistakes when you have MPE, because you don't think, oh, well, what if I move this guy from power forward to small forward? What does that open up? It's without MPE, you can kind of quickly look and play around with stuff. You just have more decision points without it, so you're more likely to make unnecessary mistakes.
Anything else you want to touch on before we get out of here?
No, I think that's it.
Guys, if you have any questions, feel free to hit us up in our premium Discord on Twitter. I'm at Josh Engelman. He's at ShipMyMoneyDFS. He and I are going to be doing a lot of content together moving forward for strategy shows. I'll have the process show and contenders Monday through Friday. Adam will be back for the deeper dives, I assume, Monday through Friday. Adam will be back for those shows. And then we'll still have Live Before Locks from 6 to 7. But hit us up if you have any questions, if you're interested in anything else. We're going to be talking NBA a lot moving forward, and it all kicks off tomorrow morning at 6:30 a.m. with the Process Show. Good luck this season, everybody. Have some fun. We will talk to you later.